How did you happen to get in here?
I ran here. You scared the daylights out of me last night.
Seems like the truth shouldn't scare anybody, man or boy.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Dragon King Dark, episode number 321. I'm your host, Carl Stern. This podcast is produced by and distributed by whenitwascool.com, which is the website I cooperate with my wife at, obviously, whenitwascool.com. We hope you'll come over there and support us. We are a retro pop culture website that produces not only Dragon King Dark, but the When It Was Cool flagship podcast, and many, many more, reviewing and discussing, talking about popular culture, especially retro pop culture, all the stuff that's fun in your life, art, music, printed material, TV, movies, and more, and pop culture in general. And today's show and this entire series, not necessarily fun, but hopefully educational. And hopefully you've learned something from it so far. This is 100 of the darkest moments in pop culture history. We have gone past the halfway point in this series so far, and I hope you have learned a lot from it. As we look at how there have been, over history, multiple negative events that have influenced and shaped popular culture. A lot of these have been very tragic events. They've been the death of some sort of performer or artist, a musician, a movie star, an athlete, something like that that changed the course of popular culture history. Think about the death of Elvis and Kurt Cobain and people like that, how that changed music. What music would they have made in the future? What artists came out really influenced by them? That changed popular culture. And we're going into sort of a sub-series right now. This kind of came to my mind when another one of the shows on our When It Was Cool podcasting network, a show that you sometimes see on the free feed for Dragon King Dark called Stuck in the Desert. Okay, we have a third-party podcast provider there, The Desert Rat, who also reviews popular culture and talks about various other things. And he had recently reviewed the classic TV series America's Most Wanted. And as I was listening to his show, which, again, is free, you can check it out at whenitwascool.com, I got to thinking about the subgenre of podcasting in popular culture, which has become, you know, very important. Obviously, we built a whole business on top of that premise that people like and listen to podcasts. And I'll say probably the most popular genre of podcasting is the true crime series. Now, true crime's been predated by, you know, movie makers, documentary filmmakers. The documentary has been around for a long time, the televised documentary. There have been documentary movies. There have been documentary TV shows. There's even channels on television now dedicated just to documentaries, especially revolving around true crime, where various experts and talking heads discuss crimes that have happened. And you, as the the detached third party at home, you kind of get to put yourself in the place of a juror. Now, many of these true crime documentaries, podcasts, true crime series and stuff are often quite biased, and they're presented using real facts, but in terms of entertainment. They're trying to lead you to a conclusion, usually a controversial one. Usually, so oftentimes, the ones that seem to make the most interesting documentaries and miniseries tend to be ones where the host or whatever company is producing it is trying to lead you to a different verdict than what the court system found by presenting to you alternate facts, alternate ideas, alternate opinions, alternate experts, examining testimony in a different sort of light. And it's made for a very entertaining subgenre of popular culture. And so for the next 3 weeks, I want to kind of look at some of the pioneers of this true crime phenomenon. We've already looked at a few of these, and these aren't necessarily people who spawned the true crime genre, but they're certainly the ones that very much inspired it, very much started people really looking into using true life criminal events to inspire entertaining productions. And in today's case, in the case of John Walsh, using this as a crime-fighting tool. He was inspired by the murder of his son to become a TV host, and he's hosted multiple TV shows over his career. Of course, the most famous is America's Most Wanted, and we'll touch on America's Most Wanted here, but again, that show, we've already done that show over at whenitwascool.com with the Stuck in the Desert podcast, so if you go over there to our podcast section at our website, you'll find that show, and I encourage you to listen to it because, again, it inspired me to do this sort of this mini series within a series. So let's talk about John Walsh, John Edward Walsh Jr. He's still alive. He's 76 years old. He was born December the 26th, 1945. And by most accounts, I mean, he was just a normal person, normal everyday person like you and I. He's had a family, was married, and had children, and how he got cast into stardom, how he became a pop culture figure, was through a extraordinarily tragic event. His son was murdered. He's well known now for his anti-crime activism, with which he became involved following the murder of his son Adam in 1981. So again, since we cover predominantly retro pop culture, this puts it right in the zone of stuff I certainly remember growing up. I was 10 years old in 1981, and obviously this was all over the news. In 2008, the late serial killer Otis Toole was officially named as Adam's killer, and we'll hear in a few moments, actually hear the press conference discussing that, and John Walsh discussing the naming of his son's killer. He was part owner, John Walsh was part owner of the now defunct National Museum of Crime and Punishment in Washington, D.C. He also anchors an investigative documentary series, The Hunt with John Walsh, which debuted on CNN in 2014. Now, John Walsh was born in Auburn, New York, one of four children. He graduated from Auburn, New York's Our Lady of Mount Carmel High School in 1963 and attended the University of Buffalo, where he graduated in 1967 with a Bachelor of Arts degree in history. He married Revy Drew in 1971, and in fact, I believe he's still married to her. They've been married for like 50 years now, which is a miracle. Usually when families go through a very traumatic experience like the death of a child, the rate of divorce goes up incredibly so. And they've had their turmoil. They've had their trials and turmoil. There's been allegations of drug use and other things. But who can judge a person, a family, who has had their son literally murdered by a serial killer? I mean, it's a wonder the coping mechanisms weren't worse than what they were. And certainly John Walsh's activism for crime fighting is to be commended despite his struggles. After college, the Walshes settled in South Florida, where John Walsh became involved in building high-end luxury hotels. But in the summer of 1981, John Walsh was an official with Paradise Island Hotel and Casino in the Bahamas, and he worked in Hollywood, Florida. He and his wife had a six-year-old son, Adam. So Adam was 3 years younger than I was at the time. On July the 27th, 1981, Adam Walsh was abducted from a Sears department store at the then-named Hollywood Mall across from the Hollywood Police Station. John's wife had left Adam in the toy department at a model video game console at the Sears while looking for a lamp. Now, here in 2022, and largely because of the cases like this, in this particular case, parents don't let children out of their sight. But look, as a kid myself in 1981, and that's where the parents dumped you off at, was the toy aisle to go shopping. You know, go look at the toys while you, one of the parents, you know, look at tools or whatever else they were going to look at in the Sears. And that was a perfectly acceptable form of child care back in 1981, as ridiculous as it sounds today. But it's situations like this that caused a change in again, popular culture and lifestyle in the United States. This case had lots of ramifications. If you wonder, were things like Stranger Danger and all these programs and stuff and all these things you know about watching kids and the outright moral panic and fear that came across the nation because of stranger abductions and stuff, largely revolved around the Adam Walsh case and popularity and the mainstream media coverage it got. Police records in Adam's case released in 1996 show that a 17-year-old security guard instructed four boys to leave the department store. Adam has been thought to be one of them. 16 days after the abduction, his severed head was found in a drainage canal 120 miles away from his home. The rest of his body was never found and still to this day, hasn't been located. Many names had been mentioned in connection to the case since the murder, but the detectives kept returning to that of serial killer Otis Toole. John Walsh had long said he believed that Toole, a drifter, was responsible for the crime, saying investigators found a pair of green shorts and a sandal similar to what Adam was wearing at Toole's home in Jacksonville, Florida. In 2007, deceased serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer fell under suspicion himself for the murder of Adam. But the speculation was discounted by Walsh in an America's Most Wanted statement on February 6, 2007. Toole, who's the prime suspect in Adam's abduction and murder, died in prison in 1996 while serving a life sentence for other crimes. The Hollywood Police Department officially identified him as Adam's killer on December 16, 2008, and the case was considered closed. Over the years, Toole had twice confessed to the killing, but both times he later recanted his admissions. In addition to the Walsh murder, Toole had claimed responsibility for hundreds of other murders, but the police determined that most of these confessions were lies. So again, we had an unreliable narrator here just because he confessed to it. He confessed to a lot of things, but ultimately, investigations and John Walsh himself, as you'll hear coming up, was convinced of Toole's being the killer of his son. Now then, following the crime, the Walsh family founded the Adam Walsh Child Resource Center, which was a nonprofit organization dedicated to legislative reform. The center is originally located in West Palm Beach, Florida, Columbia, South Carolina, California, New York, among other places, merged with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, where John Walsh serves on the board of directors. So everybody's heard of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Many times you go into public places, Walmart department stores, famously for one, you see these big posters for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Anytime there's a missing child, you hear that name invoked. Well, again, you can thank John Walsh, not for the center itself, but for popularizing it and becoming very important in its in it becoming a huge deal and recovering many children in the process. The Walsh family organized a political campaign to help missing and exploited children. But despite various problems, John and his wife's efforts eventually led to the creation of the Missing Children's Act of 1982. And the Missing Children's Assistance Act of 1984. Today, John Walsh continues to testify before Congress and state legislatures on crime, missing children, and victims' rights issues. His latest efforts include lobbying for a constitutional amendment for victims' rights. The Adam Walsh Child Protection Safety Act was signed into law by President George W. Bush on July 27, 2006, following a 2-year journey through the United States Congress. It was intensely lobbied for by Walsh and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Primarily, it focuses on a national sex offender registry, tough penalties for failing to register as a sex offender following release from prison, and civilian access to state websites that track sex offenders. Critics argue that the system amounts to making offenders wear a lifelong scarlet letter regardless of the circumstances of their cases. And myself being involved in law enforcement, I do recognize that as an issue. Now, again, I think we can all agree that the sex offender registry database is a great idea and a very useful tool. Speaking as someone in law enforcement, it is an invaluable tool. It's priceless to have this tool and a way to track sex offenders and stuff. I have myself used this to capture a sexual predator before, and it's used all over. Now, again, the net perhaps is cast a little too widely sometimes, and there is, I think we can also agree, a difference between someone who perhaps is a, you know, just a creepy sexual harasser versus a child predator, a child rapist, or something like that. There needs to be some sort of, you know, boundary set in there, and sometimes those are set a little too wide where, you know, some people who have literally committed no real sexual offense are, you know, usually this is part of plea bargains, by the way, they'll plea to being put on the sex offender registry despite not really being a danger to the public. But this is one of those situations where I think the good outweighs the bad so significantly that, and who's going to outcry against, you know, for that registry to be tampered with? Obviously, nobody is. And so it's in place as well it should be. And it's been who knows how many sexual abductions and crimes against children have been prevented. I mean, I know for myself for sure, just in ones I've been involved in, I can think of the top of my head one absolute case that I was involved in where this was unquestionably somebody being on the sex offender registry database literally saved a potential abduction. By the late 1990s, many malls, department stores, supermarkets, and other retailers have adopted what is known as a Code Adam, a movement first started by Walmart stores in the southeastern United States. A Code Adam is announced when a child is missing in a store or if a child is found by a store employee or customer. If the child is lost or missing, all doors will be locked, and a store employee is posted at every exit. While a description of the child is generally broadcast over the intercom system, Code Adam, as a term, has become synonymous with a missing child and is a predecessor to the Amber Alert, which serves as a system of broadcast-driven community notification. Do you see how this one case so influenced so many of the safety protocols we have in place in America today? And well, we should. Now then, John eventually ends up in television, of course, but there's been others. In 1983, there was an NBC television film dramatizing the days following Adam's disappearance. The actual John Walsh and his wife actually appeared at the end of the show, or the end of the movie. Later, a sequel called Adam, His Song Continues, was produced and aired. After securing a deal with Fox, John Walsh launched America's Most Wanted in 1988. By that time, Walsh was already well known because of the murder of his son and his subsequent actions to help missing and exploited children. America's Most Wanted was the longest-running crime reality show in Fox history and contributed to the capture of more than 1,000 fugitives. Fox canceled the series in June of 2011, but aired four specials during the 2011-2012 season. On December 2nd, 2011, the series returned as a regular weekly first-run series on Lifetime. The last episode aired in October of 2012, 5 months later. In March 2013, Lifetime officially canceled the series. Walsh also hosted his own daytime talk show, The John Walsh Show, which aired in syndication from 2002 to 2004. However, since America's Most Wanted was still in the air at the time, he found it difficult to host both shows, so he asked then NBC Entertainment President Jeff Zucker to release him from his contract, which was granted. In 2003, John Walsh assisted in solving the kidnapping of Elizabeth Smart on an episode of America's Most Wanted, where Ed Smart showed the picture of Brian David Mitchell's Emmanuel appearance. Mitchell's stepchildren saw the episode, identified him, and called the show. This led to the rescue of Elizabeth Smart and the arrest of Brian David Mitchell and Wanda Beres. After Elizabeth Smart was reunited with her family, John Walsh later met Elizabeth and her family, inviting them to meet her, and they mentioned his hand in finding her. So again, another very famous case he was responsible or partially responsible for solving. In 2005, Walsh attempted to assist the family of missing teen Natalie Holloway. Walsh was critical of the Rubin crime investigation and, along with television personality Dr. Phil, urged Americans to boycott Aruba. Walsh was a special guest on an episode of Extreme Makeover Home Edition, which aired on 2005. And again, you know, he's been in all kinds of stuff. True Hollywood Story, biography. Walsh later was a host of The Hunt with John Walsh. And he is the spokesperson for the American Digital Multicast Network, Justice Network, again. You know, here we go into the arena of true crime. So let's hear the press conference where Toole was named as the killer of Adam Walsh. And then when we return after our mid-show break, we'll talk a little bit more about America's Most Wanted, the true crime series, and more about the death, the murder of Adam Walsh.
For 27 years, we've been asking who could take a six-year-old boy and murder him and decapitate him. Who? We needed to know. And today we know. The not knowing has been a torture, but that journey's over. And a lot of horrible memories in this police department looking for that little boy. And now I think it's only fitting that it ends here in this police department. And there are a lot of good people here today. I always, for years, I tried to convince myself that justice delayed was not justice denied. And I don't know how you've done it for all these years, but we're blessed with these three beautiful children. That little girl right there, that big girl, probably saved our lives because she was born a year after Adam, when we were spiraling into hell. And those two boys are a blessing, too. We're lucky to have them. And Reve and I have had some very, very rough and rocky times. But you always never lost focus of who the real victim was. You never lost focus. You never didn't drive this train, Reve. But that little boy was the real victim. There's a lot of people to thank. And Chad Wagner, this chief right here, I've been through several chiefs. Both of us have. We've been through several detectives. And this isn't a look back, and this isn't to point fingers. This is to let that rest. The Hollywood police, it's a different group. Mark Smith worked this case very hard for years. Chief Wagner made the decision to end our pain. We believed for years that Otis Toole killed Adam. and a couple of guys were with us all the way. And they're here today, too. Kelly Hancock, sitting right over there. He was assistant district attorney for Broward County. And he has helped me and advised me all these years pro bono and said, I believe in my heart that Otis Toole killed Adam. He said, I put guys on death row in Florida with less evidence. Someday we will convince the Broward County State Attorney's Office that Otis Toole did it. And Kelly's here today. Ravey and I thank you, Kelly. You're an honor to your profession. He's a private attorney now and a really wonderful one. But this man never gave up helping us. And Joe Matthews, sitting next to him. Joe Matthews was an active detective, homicide investigator and polygrapher 27 years ago, hired by the Hollywood Police Department to polygraph Ravey and I for hours and hours. And he was the first one that told the then chief, I know the Walshes didn't have anything to do with this. I know that this direction of this investigation is the wrong direction. And he was fired from that job by that chief back then. And he has never stopped looking for Adam's murder. He put this case together. He's traveled the whole country pro bono. He's interviewed hundreds of people. And he's worked closely with the Hollywood police to come to this conclusion. That's a real man right there. As a cop, a retired cop who never gave up. Our heartfelt thanks to all the people that have helped us over the years. We've had so many good people help us. Look for Adam, change laws. Ravey created the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children out of our grief, and we didn't do it alone, did we, Ravey? We had lots and lots of good people that helped us. Lots of people here in South Florida. This is where it all started, our home base. We still have great love for South Florida. Some of the best laws in the country, some of the biggest changes were started right here in South Florida. These are the people who look for Adam the hardest. So, the not knowing is almost as bad as the murder, but today's a good day. Today's a wonderful day. We can end this chapter of our lives. It's not about closure. See that picture of that little boy? We'll always be the parent of that, the murdered little boy. It's about justice. And for all the other victims who haven't gotten justice, I say one thing. Don't give up hope. Don't give up hope. Thank you, Chief. Thank you for having the guts to do this. Thank you. God bless you.
John, what advice do you give for parents of victims of unsolved crimes?
I say to parents of missing children, murdered children, to all crime victims in America. The criminal justice system is sometimes the criminal injustice system. I've seen it firsthand. Sometimes it doesn't work, but there isn't a better system. I've never seen one in the whole world, and I've hunted fugitives all over the world. Don't give up hope. Sometimes you have to stay in there yourself. Sometimes you're the best and last hope to get justice for yourself.
Do you wish Otis Toole was alive today?
I'm not about revenge. We never have been. I don't believe in vigilantism. I believe wherever he is paying and being held accountable for his actions. Who could kill a six-year-old boy? But I've been involved in thousands of cases since then. I believe that Otis Toole is probably getting where what he deserves. Somewhere.
How does this change your advocacy for missing children?
I don't know what to say. I always tell people, don't give up. Don't lose hope. We'll still continue. There's so much to be done. I think the most positive thing that the Hollywood police collectively said to Ravey and I were, we changed the way we do business and look for missing children after Adam, and police all over the world had. So, you know, Ravey and I tried very hard to make sure Adam didn't die in vain. Today, this is a reaffirmation of the fact that he didn't die in vain, that beautiful little boy.
Excuse me, please. Let's don't talk negatively. Speaking of winners, surprise, surprise, whenitwascool.com is your home for retro pop culture articles and podcasts. To all our patron supporters, this is for you, Fannie Mae. Solid gold just like you and me. Family friendly and fun, whenitwascool.com.
Now, the famous America's Most Wanted wasn't born in a bubble. There were obviously earlier similar shows and ones overseas. In fact, there was a famous German show where they kind of got the basic idea for what America's Most Wanted was going to be. There was a British show called Crime Watch that aired in the 1980s as well. Largely based of what America's Most Wanted was around these other shows, but certainly it took a life of its own here in the U.S. The Walsh crime had, of course, been the subject of the 1983 television film, which we talked about in the first part of the show, called Adam. And Walsh's later advocacy had resulted in new legislation to protect missing children, as well as we mentioned, of the creation of, and this may end up being his enduring legacy into the future, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. After lengthy discussions, John Walsh agreed to host America's Most Wanted, and it debuted as a half-hour program on February 7, 1988, and then on multiple Fox-owned and operated stations, including the very large and prestigious New York, Los Angeles, Washington, Chicago, Dallas, and Boston markets. Within 4 days of the first broadcast, FBI's 10 Most Wanted fugitive, David James Roberts, was captured as a direct result. So from the very first pilot episode, this show was getting results. He was a convicted killer who had recently escaped from prison by digging his way out with a small axe. This demonstrated the effectiveness of the show's watch television catch criminals premise to skeptical law enforcement agencies. 10 weeks later, the program premiered nationwide on the Fox network and became the fledgling network's first hit series. In 1990, the show's format was changed from 30 minutes to 60 minutes. But then eventually in 1995, it was cut back to 30, but for the bulk of its run, it was a 60-minute show. There was even a short-lived syndicated spinoff called America's Most Wanted, Final Justice. And the show has gone through, cancellations, been brought back, changed television networks, went from Fox to Lifetime. In fact, in 2021, Fox announced that it would revive America's Most Wanted with a new host, Elizabeth Vargas, with the full endorsement of John Walsh, and who even said he would appear when he contractually could because he was at the In Pursuit series out as well. The revival premiered March 15th, 2021. And, again, so this show just has a ongoing legacy. The one of the more, I think, famous things the America's Most Wanted is known for is the Dirty Dozen. And this was America's Most Wanted's Dirty Dozen was John Walsh's list of notorious fugitives who've been profiled on the show who were at the time at large. It was similar in function, though not identical, to the FBI's 10 Most Wanted Fugitives list. These are the Dirty Dozen as of January 8, 2013. Currently, there are 8 of these fugitives still wanted, despite the idea of being on the list, being John Walsh's 12 personal most wanted. The 11th, Andre Neverson, was arrested in 2018. Paul Jackson was arrested in 2015. Farrell Hackney was removed after his body was discovered in September of 2012, and alleged murderer William Joseph Greer has also been removed from the Dirty Dozen list, despite him seemingly still being on the run. And these are his Dirty Dozen. They were Jason Derrick Brown, who's wanted for murder of an armored car driver and a theft of $56,000 in Phoenix, Arizona, back in 2004. Jose Fernando Corona, he's out of Louisville, Texas, murdered his wife with a chainsaw on April 26, 2010. Bernie Figuera, was wanted for the murder of 2-year-old Alexa Lopez in Brenham, Texas. And Robert Fisher, wanted for murdering his wife, Mary, and his two children in Scottsdale, Arizona in 2001. He is also on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list. Alexis Flores, wanted for kidnapping and murder of a five-year-old in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania in the year 2000. She's also on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. Francisco Javier Lopez Gonzalez is wanted for the murder of his stepson. L.B. Harz is wanted for sexual abuse in Columbia, South Carolina. And Daniel Ayers, wanted for the murder of his wife in Goose Creek, South Carolina in 2005. Paul Jackson and his sibling, Vance Roberts, were apparently kidnapping people and taking them to a homemade torture chamber they had built in a residence. This has happened in Hillsboro, Oregon. And let's see, on Jackson escaped prison in 1990 and was on the run until 2015. September 28, 2015, was arrested by immigration officials in Guadalajara, Mexico, where Jackson appeared to be had been living for years using an alias. So Andre Neverson was wanted for the murders of his sister and ex-girlfriend in Brooklyn, New York in 2002. He was captured, I guess we said, in 2018. And finally, Yasher Saeed was wanted for shooting his two teenage daughters in 2008 in Irving, Texas. And he is on the or was on the FBI's most wanted list until he was captured 2 years ago in August of 2020 in Justin, Texas. The show and John Walsh, I mean, besides just all the myriad number of things we've already talked about, is bled over to other areas of pop culture as well. I mean, how couldn't it? These are very, very famous things. The Simpsons, Season 1, Episode, Some Enchanted Evening, featured a parody of America's Most Wanted called America's Most Armed and Dangerous, which featured a profile of Miss Botts, the Simpsons babysitter, who is nicknamed the Babysitter Bandit. In Season 6 of The Golden Girls, the fictitious mobster The Cheese Man boasted his most recent appearance on America's Most Wanted was the highest-rated episode ever. In 2019 science fiction action film Terminator Dark Fate, Sarah Connor reveals that she was featured in an entire episode of America's Most Wanted, and it's wanted in 50 states. And in an episode of the sitcom 30 Rock, Liz Lemon mentioned that she once appeared on America's Most Wanted playing a woman who was strangled. So again, just absolutely far-reaching in popular culture is this. And as we stated early on, it very much touches the genre of popular culture you're listening to now. Now, I don't really brand Dragon King Dark as true crime. We've gone through many different identities and iterations here on Dragon King Dark. Our show has evolved much over the years and will continue to do so after this series is completed. We will evolve into something else. We've covered everything from the paranormal, UFOs and ghosts and cryptozoology to commentary about society issues to history to archaeology and even touching many times on true crime. And we certainly recognize true crime as a very large chunk of American popular culture, be it on TV, movies, or audio. And so, as you'll hear, not just with this episode, which spawned a lot of the interest in things like the ID channel, things like Court TV, things like all these various, I mean, when we turn on television now, there are multiple channels devoted to true crime. You go on any podcast aggregator where you also, I hope, are looking up When It Was Cool, you can find thousands of true crime podcasts. And so it's definitely spawned or influenced this whole genre. And the next couple shows that you'll hear here have also, they're very famous cases. And they've also spawned the, you know, home detective, home juror genre of pop culture. And so now we'll conclude today's show, Dragon King Dark Episode 321, by listening to another interview, and this is a very interesting one. This is presented by the Paley Center, which is a a nonprofit organization. Certainly, you should look them up and see what they're involved with, because this is John Walsh talking to, of all people, Geraldo Rivera, very famous. Again, somebody probably inspired and influenced a lot of true crime pop culture, discussing the Adam Walsh killing and his involvement in crime fighting, basically. And so we'll end the show with on that note, but let me encourage you once more before we go to that segment to please support us over at whenitwascool.com. We need you as a Patreon supporter. We have recently made some upgrades to our website. If you haven't checked it in a while, do check back on the front page. We are really refocusing our website on our podcasts. We have also changed our Twitter handle. So if you ever followed us on Twitter previously, that account is no longer active. It no longer exists. You'll need to follow us at our new account, which is at WIWC Network. And again, you can get the link to that right off the front page, our Facebook as well. So please follow and like on all that as is appropriate. So now let's hear from the Paley Center these words from John Walsh.
In that regard, I put it in the past tense just because we all understand when I asked the question. A friend of mine whose sister went missing, and the federal authorities would not get involved because, as you know, they don't declare a kidnapping unless there's some overt evidence or some time passes, particularly back in that day. And then I noticed that our friendship was affected because they ultimately found his sister in a ditch and she had been raped and murdered. And it was because he had reached out to me to get the federal authorities involved. It was almost as if he associated me with that awful event. When I speak with you, or when you speak about the program and what you have chosen as your life work, you are invariably described as the father of a murdered missing child. How do you deal with that psychic burden? The fact that Adam's murder is part of your everyday life, lo these almost three decades later.
I walked in the shoes of all the people who come to us as the last resort. And the huge frustration was that for years I believed I knew who killed Adam and that they had bungled the evidence and Otis Toole had died in prison on death row for many other crimes. Was one of the motivators. I kept saying, if I can't get justice for myself, and I mounted the biggest search in the history of Florida with lots of my wealthy and influential friends, and I was lucky to have success early in life. And
you
all
were
those
a
things.
Hotel developer.
We were building a $26 million hotel on Paradise Island. I was a young guy. I had three partners. I went to private school. I had all those great advantages. My father was a World War II hero, well known in our town. Very handsome guy, first guy to graduate in his family from Notre Dame. You know, Irish immigrants, as my grandparents. But I had all those wonderful opportunities that most people don't get. And I kept saying to myself, if I can't get justice, if I can't get the cops to do the right thing, someday I'm going to solve Adam's case, but I got to be the voice for those voiceless. You know, I have to be the one, maybe, that through this television show, I can get back without being a vigilante. Certainly, it's given me a huge high profile. I used to wait for hours to see congressmen and governors. Once I became a TV guy, it was right in the door for the photo op. And then I would get him in the headlock, say, I'll be in your newsletter if you listen to this bill or we need to do this type of thing. It was a motivator along the way to try to solve Adam's case, to try to get justice, and also to say, we are the voice of the voiceless. We are the court of last resort. And it was a great motivator for me. It wasn't about that I was just the father of a murdered child. I had one of those dads that said, saddle up and fight back. If you're going down, go down swinging. And I had this opportunity to have millions of people, and I would say on the show, it's my bully pulpit, and I don't try to hide that. When something is opposed, I tell the public, I say, this is a good piece of legislation. Like you said, doesn't matter what side of the aisle. It's not right, left, it's bipartisan. It's for the people. And it was my pulpit, and it energized me. It still energizes me. It was a wonderful experience to go to the White House yesterday. I had met Barack Obama when he was a rookie. He talked about it. He said, I met you on the halls of Congress when I was a rookie senator, and you stopped and talked to me. And I didn't know who Barack Obama was, except that he was a freshman senator. But the show is that pulpit. It is that high profile. I get to catch the uncatchable. I get to put millions of eyes to someone who has no voice, to someone who was murdered 30 years ago, or to a missing child that nobody's looking for except in that town where that child was missing. So it was always an energizer, you know?
Sir, thank you for your questions. I'll continue. I've got a million of them, but I would like to hear what your questions would be. So there are microphones in either aisle, so just indicate to the gentleman with the microphones. How do you and Reve, your wife, deal with, you have the three lovely children now, right? Adult children, or a teenager and two adult children. You deal every day with the open wounds of families much like you were 30 years ago. It's not just that you are doing if we do a program about a space launch or even a natural disaster, whatever it is, there is a certain emotional detachment often and with most reporters. But in your particular case, the field that you till is exactly what you two suffered through. Does it make you more empathetic? How do you deal with the psychic burden of it?
Well, first of all, Reve was the one who said years and years ago, 28 years ago now, when after Adam's murder and we were spiraling into hell and my business was descending to nowhere, I couldn't go to work, I'd lost almost 30 pounds. We had these 40,000 letters in the garage that people had sent us from all over the United States, Adam's parents, Adams, Hollywood, Florida, etc. And Reve kept reading the letters. They were, I have a teenage runaway. My non-custodial wife took our kids. We have all the problems with children. She was the one who said, you know, we got to remember who the real victim was here. Adam was the real victim. He went through the kidnapping. She was always cut to the chase. And we had lots of problems, unbearable problems, because 90% of the parents of missing children, at least that, wind up in divorce. We were blessed with these children, but she always had the focus.
90% of parents.
They say between 80, I say 90, because I've never met anybody that's really made it through.
From the stress of the event.
You have nothing in common but the horrible murder, the horrible memories. And she was the one who said, you know, go out and try to battle for the missing children's bill, which was my mission, and she started the National Center out of our garage. And I've always tried to keep that focus, and she's the one that says, when you come home and you want to do something with the kids, you leave the blood and gore and guts. Don't bring it up at the table. We don't want to. That's your job if you can deal with it. So I always try to keep the focus on, because I've been there. I begged for that help for 2 weeks. I begged for someone to cover Adam's case. I begged for years for people to get involved and help me investigate. I know what it is when those doors are slammed, when you've hit that wall, when there's nobody there to help you. So I always try to keep that in perspective, that who's the real victim? And maybe we can make a difference. And not the cliche of making a difference. There is that aspect of hope, and there is that tiny little light that if you can use your influence and what you know and how you know to do it better, and you can't let it break you down. It will break you down. It'll break your heart. But you have to remember who the victim is.
We depend on Patreon support for our website and podcast network. In order to continue these podcasts you enjoy, we need you to visit whenitwascool.com. and pledge at least $1. You'll gain access to lots of exclusive podcasts, newsletters, and more. Sign up is quick, simple, and can be canceled at any time. whenitwascool.com and click any Patreon link. Thank you.